Welcome to The Great Awakening. I'm your host, Josh Dawes. My guest today is U.S. Senator Josh Hawley from the state of Missouri. He is a strong Christian conservative there on Capitol Hill that is doing just a great job fighting for the right things there in our nation's capital. The senator has recently written a new book called Manhood, The Masculine Virtues America Needs. I finished it this morning. It's a great book. He is basically calling men to step into and live in those the roles that God has designed us for. And so we had a great conversation about that, about the state of manhood in America, what we can do about that. Talked a little bit about what it's like being a Christian in politics and how much as Christians we should be bringing our faith to the public square. So a very relevant conversation to a lot of the discourse that's happening on Christian Twitter and online spaces recently. So I think you'll get a lot out of it. It's a very helpful conversation. So let's jump right into that. Thanks for joining me, Senator.
Thanks for having me.
So you've recently written a book, Manhood, The Masculine Virtues That America Needs. What is the state of manhood in America? What concerns led you to write this book?
Well, if you look at just the numbers, you can see that men, especially young men, are having a hard time in this country right now. I mean, look at the rates of suicide at all-time highs. Look at the rates of drug abuse, alcohol abuse near all-time highs, the rates of depression, other mental illness, also off the charts. So it's getting pretty hard to deny. I mean, even on the left, you see people now saying that, yeah, there's definitely some issues with men. The opioid epidemic hit men particularly hard, particularly in the Midwest, where you had a lot of loss of jobs. And so you can look across the board and really see that men are in something that looks like a state of crisis. In terms of the personal motivations for this for me, I'm a father. I've got two small boys at home. My oldest is 10, and then I have an 8-year-old, and then I've got a baby daughter, a 2-year-old daughter. So for me, the personal impetus for this was being a dad and thinking about my boys and the world that they're facing and the messages they hear and my obligations as a father to help them grow into be the men God created them to be.
Yeah, well, I'm a father of 3 boys and a little girl myself, and so I see those concerns myself. And what would you say are some of the greatest threats that are facing, you know, boys particular today?
I think that a real loss of any sense of vision or purpose, and if you think about the message that the dominant culture, which of course is dominated by the political left, if you think about the message the left has sent really for several decades now to men, it has been that men are toxic. I quote one leftist in the book who says that talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. So there you have it. I mean, that's the leftist message in a nutshell. By being a man, you make the world a worse place. That kind of relentless messaging towards boys, towards young men, I think is extremely disorienting. And then you combine that with the broader cultural sense, again, especially on the left, that the universe itself is empty and meaningless. You know, so there's no purpose in life. There's nothing inherently true or good in the world. You kind of have to bring it. You know, if you want to have any purpose in life, you got to go out and basically create it. But if you're a man, be careful, because everything you do is destructive. So it leaves young men, I think, really adrift without a lot of role models, without a sense of vision, purpose, or calling in their lives. And that just leads to all kinds of bad outcomes. I mean, bad behavior, rising violence, depression, the things we were just talking about. So I think that the state of men in America today, young men in America, is one that's very challenged, and it's driven by, I think, this loss of vision and purpose.
Yeah, in your book, you draw kind of some causality from a kind of ancient philosophy of Epicureanism. Can you explain what that is and how that kind of maps onto the modern liberalism? I thought that was very insightful.
Yeah, sure. I think the easiest way, the shorthand way to understand that is that modern liberalism, modern Epicureanism, if you like, basically says the self is God. Pleasure is God. Pursue pleasure to make yourself happy. And the core message is, again, that there's no meaning in the universe. It's basically an atheistic mindset, that there's no God, that there's no eternity, there's no heaven and hell. You should do what makes you happy, because that's all there is. At the end of the day, none of our lives are going to matter. So in this brief time we have on earth, just try and be as happy as you can, however you can. I think that's the ancient Epicurean mindset. It has become the modern liberal mindset. And I think it's at the root of much of our current sense of cultural purposelessness and drift, because there's no vision in that. There's no call in that. There's no adventure in that. And you combine that with the message that men get, and I think you begin to get a picture of why it is young men today especially seem so disoriented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like how in the book you kind of contrast that against the biblical narrative of really Adam, you know, on down through the history of Israel and just all the great patriarchs and the virtue, the masculine virtues that they, you know, that they give, you know, it's an example of. Can you talk about why we need to go back to the Bible to find these? We can't just find it, you know, out there making meaning ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the first thing to say about this is that just from a historical perspective, the biblical tradition is the foundation morally, intellectually of Western civilization and of American culture. I mean, that's just true. You can like it or not like it, but that's just true as a matter of historical fact. Then you add on to that the sense that the biblical tradition happens to be true, in my opinion. I mean, I'm a Christian. That comes through in the book loud and clear. At least I hope it does. Mm-hmm. And so for me, in this moment of cultural disorientation, the place to turn is to our first guides, so to speak. It's back to the foundations. And that's why I go back to the Bible and try to recover that biblical sense of meaning, purpose for the world and for men. And just to state that in a nutshell, the biblical view is that the world has great meaning because it's created by a God who has purpose for the world. He created the world to be a temple. He created it to be something beautiful. He created it to be a place where he would dwell with man and woman. And he put men and he put women into the creation to help make the creation what it could be. And that's the Genesis picture. And I try to recover some of the symbolism, some of the deep symbolism and significance of the Genesis narrative for men and say, men, hey, this is a great vision. I mean, your life, you're meant to cooperate with God. You're meant to help build the world into what it could be. Your life has tremendous meaning and value.
Yeah. It seems to me that we've, America's kind of coasted on the kind of echoes of that Christian foundation for several generations. And whereas, you know, maybe, you know, a few generations before us, there was more of kind of a common moral framework that we kind of all shared in common. But it seems more and more today that, you know, the left and right are operating from two kind of diametrically opposed moral frameworks. What hope do you have of, you know, being able to make that work in the Republic?
Well, I mean, I think that every society has some moral framework that informs it. That's why it's a society and not a business. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the difference between a corporation and a society. A corporation is not necessarily founded on any shared moral purpose. Its purpose is profits. You know, that's fine. But that's not what a society is. A society is a group of families and associations and neighborhoods who come together around a shared sense of moral purpose, moral principles, usually language. So, you know, I think we're living in a moment in American history where we're really having a pretty significant struggle over the most basic things we believe as a nation. And that's why our politics is so acrimonious, in my view, is that we really are now fighting over fundamentals. And I think you've put your finger on it, which is that the basic biblical tradition that has undergirded what Abraham Lincoln used to call American civil religion, you know, it used to undergird our basic cultural sense of who we are as Americans. That is now deeply, deeply contested. You know, the left rejects that. A lot of this talk about America being a systemically racist, bigoted, oppressive nation really is an attack on the biblical tradition that undergirds our history and culture. It's really an attempt, I think, to root that out. A lot of the cultural Marxism that we see that's so prevalent now on the left is really aimed at the biblical elements in our culture. So it's a pretty significant disagreement over the fundamentals of American society, over our fundamental identity. And I think that's, you know, that's why we are where we are. I mean, what's the outcome of that going to be? I don't know. I mean, I think That's one of the exciting times about living when we do and as we do, is that the future is yet to be written here. I do think that the notion that America would just become a place where nobody really agrees on the purpose or meaning or promise of this nation, that's just not going to happen. I mean, we're going to coalesce around a group of common principles. The left wants those principles to be their woke ideology, their cultural Marxism. The conservatives should want it to be the grand tradition of the West, which is rooted fundamentally in the tradition of the Bible. So that's the debate right there.
Yeah. And it seems to be there's a debate on the right itself of whether or not we can kind of have that, the libertarian ideal of, you know, a neutral secular, you know, public square where we have this marketplace of ideas and the best ideas win. It seems like to me that the past few years particularly have really kind of laid that bare, that we are going to have some, you know, moral framework that we have to unite around. How do we encourage those on our side to become, you know, I guess, regain the will to kind of govern from that moral framework?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to realize that there really does have to be a shared moral framework, and that this is something that, this is an ancient debate, right? This isn't a new one. I mean, this has been something that you can go back to Plato, you can go back to Aristotle, you can go back to the first lowercase r Republican thinkers in the tradition that ultimately becomes our tradition of self-government, and you will hear them saying that there have to be certain fundamental principles that we agree on together. A vision of the good is the sort of classical way of putting it in sort of Greek thought and Greek philosophy, good with a capital G. I mean, every society is going to have, that's a society, it's going to have some vision of the good. What is it going to be? And I think for on the right, I think there's been this trend over the last 40, 50 years, a lot of the right has actually accepted the left's talking points. Actually, no, we don't need a common vision of the good. The society will basically be one big corporation. You know, we'll just maximize profit making. That's basically what society is. Nah, that's not what society is. And what's happening now is the left is abandoning those talking points. The left is saying, no, actually, we have a very substantive view of what society should be and what our fundamental principles should be. And they should be these principles of equity and their redefinition of what counts as equality, and they should be a new form of atheism, which is really, I think, at the root of much of their ideology. And you see this again in their cultural Marxist agenda. That for them, those for them, are the fundamental principles we ought to unite around. So I just say to my friends on the right, fellow travelers, you know, wake up and get with it. It's one or the other. You know, we're going to unite around some vision because that's what nations do. So the question is, which vision is it going to be? And let me just make one other point here, Josh, and that is that, you know, I'm a religious liberty lawyer. That's what I did before I got into politics. So I believe profoundly in the right of religious liberty. And I don't just mean religious liberty for Christians. I mean for everybody. I represented a lot of folks who don't share my, in fact, most of my clients didn't share my beliefs at all, and I didn't share theirs. That's fine. That's great. But let's not kid ourselves. The right to religious liberty, that sense of liberty of conscience, that liberality, if you like, that also stems out of the biblical tradition. It's the biblical tradition that insists on liberty of conscience for all. So, you know, I think it would be a mistake to say, oh, we can try to find principles that are somehow completely independent of any vision of the good, any substantive moral framework. That's just a myth. That doesn't exist. We're going to have to coalesce around some vision. What's it going to be?
Yeah. What do you make of, in my space, there's a lot of, really the past year or so, there's been a lot of debate around the term Christian nationalism and whether or not, I think it's, you know, pretty commonly accepted that if you're a Christian and you want to be involved in politics on the conservative side, you're going to be hit with that label. There's a debate of whether or not we need to accept that label, we should run from it or whatever. But a lot of that debate stays kind of very theoretical in the, kind of like, what does this ideal Christian nation look like, you know, somewhere down their line? But I've been more concerned with, like, what do we do now? What are some, you know, concrete things that we can do now? As a Christian who is a U.S. senator, where are you at on that whole Christian nationalism thing? And what are some things that, you know, we can do to kind of really bring our faith to the public square?
Yeah, if that means that, if the question is, should Christianity have cultural influence, then yeah, I mean, absolutely. And do we want to have a culture? Is it a good thing to have a culture that is shaped broadly by Christianity, by the tradition of the Bible? I would say, yes, it is, manifestly. That's what America has been and until it still is. But I think that's really what we're fighting over. So I think that, you know, people use the phrase Christian nationalism. I've heard it used in all different kinds of ways, almost always derogatory, but even the substantive content, I'm never quite sure when people use it, like what are we talking about? So just bracketing that, setting that term to one side, I think that as Christians, we shouldn't be shy about saying, yeah, we want the foundational tenets of our faith, we want those to have cultural influence. Does that mean that we want to impose our beliefs on others? No. Do we want there to be a union of church and state? I don't. I mean, can you imagine if we had a national church? I mean, how woke it would be. So no, I mean, no. Again, that gets back to, I believe in liberty of conscience because I am a Christian. And that means conscience, liberty of conscience for all people. So, you know, the separation of church and state in a healthy way, free state in a free, or free church rather, in a free state, that stems out of the Christian tradition, in my view. So I think that we should be for trying to extend a healthy Christian influence. That, what does that look like? Insists on the dignity of all people, insists on the reality of biological sex, men and women, that it's good to be a man, it's good to be a woman, those things are different, that insists on protecting the unborn, that insists on the dignity of work and the dignity of workers and those who give their life to work, especially those who perform manual labor. And I think some of these foundational commitments that have been true in our history, we need to recover and continue to work to extend forward into our future. And I think that a lot of those stem out of the Christian influence. Mm-hmm.
White evangelicals get a lot of grief. They're kind of characterized as being like overly concerned with politics. And but I saw a survey online this week showing that white evangelicals are the least politically engaged group amongst the list of demographics that was surveyed. And that seems to play out in my, you know, local context, that it's, there's a reluctance amongst a lot of Christians to get involved politically. What encouragement would you have for Christians to that politics actually matters, that we can make a difference?
Well, I would think that if you start even with Romans 13, for example, where you have Paul talk about those who serve in positions of authority, those who exercise authority, he refers to them as, he uses the same word for them, ministers, as he does for those who serve the church. I mean, so there is a sense in which what happens in government matters. What happens in politics matters. So I think that as Christians, you know, part of our service to the Lord and part of our service to our neighbor is to care about what are the conditions of our neighborhoods, what is the condition of our state, and ultimately, what is the condition of our nation? You know, is this a place where life is honored? Is this a place where the dignity of every person is honored and respected? And so I think that being involved in politics is not a nice add-on. I mean, it's something that is pretty fundamental. It's part of our witness, in my view, and making sure that, seeing that we have a society that reflects the good, flourishing order that God intends, the order of liberty, the order of fullness, the order of flourishing that God intends, I think is important.
I think a lot of the reluctance probably stems from a problem that I think is kind of evident in a lot of young men too, that there just seems to be this lack of agency, that it's kind of like, well, what are you going to do? You know, times are bad, it's crazy, but how can we make a difference? What can we do as a culture, society, to kind of help young men rediscover that sense of agency, that their lives do matter?
Can I go back before? That's a great question, but can I just put a sharper point on the question you just asked a second ago, and just make a point that I think sometimes is taken for granted? I think it's sometimes easy for Christians, and listen, I'm an evangelical. I grew up an evangelical. I think it's sometimes easy for evangelicals to take for granted the protections for worship and for religious liberty that we have, that are formally in our Constitution and that we've enjoyed culturally. But my message would be, if you think that you can withdraw from the culture and withdraw from politics and that you'll be left alone to practice your faith, you're very wrong. Mm-hmm. You're very wrong. And I think the experience of the COVID era ought to really bring that home. I mean, who did the government come after and treat disequally? It was churches and synagogues. Now, who did they shut down and who did they show disfavor towards? It was churches and synagogues and houses of worship. I mean, they're the ones who were disfavored. So you can see where this will go. I mean, the idea that, oh, everyone will always agree that faith is important, that we'll always protect the right to freedom of worship, freedom of expression, and the freedom to live our, to follow our faith in public. Oh, no, that the left doesn't agree on those things anymore. And I can tell you, I sit in the United States Senate. It's no longer you can count on broad bipartisan support for the notion of liberty of conscience and liberty of worship. You cannot count on that. To the left, they say, nah, those are code words for values we don't like. Those are code words for bigotry and oppression and racism. So there's a real struggle here. And I just think part of the point that Christians need to hear is if you don't engage, if you don't carry out your duties as citizens, I think duties that are laid upon us by the Lord, then this country will look very, very different. And I think we'll ultimately have to give some account for that. I mean, what did we do with the liberties and the responsibilities that the Lord gave us in this moment in history? What did we do with those? And I don't think it'll be enough to say, well, you know, I kept out of it. I kept my hands clean and I just, you know, I just focused on other things. Well, I don't know what will happen to the country if that's what Christians do.
Yeah.
Now, you asked about young men, though. What can we do for young men, right? And how can we?
Yeah. To help them. Regain agency, you know, a sense that their life can matter.
Well, I think vision is such a huge part of this. I think a sense of purpose and vision. And that's why in the book, I go back to the Bible and I try to recover what I think is the biblical vision for a man's life. And one of the foundational biblical principles that I think we find there is that God has built the universe in such a way that if you will accept responsibility, if you will step into the roles that he has intended for you, your life will matter. So in a very practical sense, for young men, I think we ought to unequivocally as Christians and even as a culture send the message, it is a good thing to get married and have a family. If you want to change the world, get married, have a family. That will change the destiny of your life. It will change the destiny of your neighborhood, and it will change the destiny of this nation. So I think that the roles of husband and father are so critical and key. And if you want to have agency, you want to get some purchase in your life, go and do the things, take on the responsibility that God has built you for. And being a husband, being a father, I think is really, really foundational for that. Work is also foundational. We could talk about that if you want. Service to others, of course. But I think at a very practical level, the message to young men about taking up responsibility, about reclaiming the biblical vision for their life, I mean, that's really how you begin to see your life matter.
Yeah, let's talk about work. I really appreciated the chapter on work and agreed with so much of it, just in how it gives you know, young men a sense of purpose and mission to work toward. How can young men, the workplace has gotten harder, especially in corporate America. I work in the tech industry, and I've heard so many stories of just DEI policies that leave men with a sense of like, what's the point? I can't get ahead. They don't want me to succeed. They're keeping me down. What can we do to help men in those situations to, you know, not give up?
Well, I think the first thing is to send the message that work is good. God has built you to work. Work matters. And that the Lord wants to work with you through the labor that you do to bring his influence to the world. And I think we should not lose sight of that. You know, work is not just something that we do to earn money, pass the time so that we can have plenty of money to spend on entertainment. I mean, I think that's kind of the cultural default more and more. And I think it's natural for young men, easy for young men to feel that way increasingly. That's not the biblical vision. You know, and our Puritan forebears in this country had a wonderful, high sense of the dignity of work, that it is something that is done for the Lord. It is a ministry unto itself. And that no matter where you are, if you are doing something that is a help to others and that is honorable, the Lord will use it to extend his influence, to build his kingdom, to create something that truly lasts in the most ultimate sense. So I think that that significance of work is something that young men need to hear and need to be called into. And then, you know, in our current cultural environment, obviously it'll vary workplace by workplace, but this is a moment, I think, where young men, you know, it's like in certain industries, and you mentioned one of them, I'm sure that I haven't worked in the tech industry, but I've heard plenty of stories. And even my friends and compatriots, I'm a lawyer by training, those who do corporate law say much the same thing. I mean, this is a time in our country's history where being bold in your faith and actually opening your faith is probably going to cost you something in the workplace, in many of these corporate workplaces. It probably will. And if you are bold in your stance for Christ, if you say, no, actually, I am a Christian, if you say, you know, I'm not going to go along with some of this ideology of you know, no male or female, this ideology of the radical cultural Marxist agenda, the equity agenda, as they now often label it, that's going to cost you something. But I think our message to men is we don't need to be, as Christians, we don't need to be we don't need to be belligerent. I mean, there's no need to go seek controversy. There's no need to stick your finger in people's eye and seek out dissent or controversy. But I do think there's a place to boldly stand and say, wait a minute, I'm not gonna agree with something that's untrue just because you're telling me we're all doing it. And I think obviously this situation has to be navigated workplace by workplace. But this is a time when taking a stand may cost you. And there's a dignity and an honor in that, I think, for Christians to say that they're willing to do that. And this is why, all the more reason why men need mentors. You know, younger men need men like you, not that you're old, Josh, but you know, need guys who are a little farther along to say, here's how I navigated that, or here's how I am navigating that in my industry. And so I think it makes that connection between men and the church and otherwise all the more important.
Yeah. As a religious liberty lawyer, what sort of protections are there for Christians in those kind of corporate environments?
Well, they ought to be pretty robust in the sense that the basic sense of freedom of conscience, freedom of free expression, free exercise, freedom of expression is a general right. Free exercise is a more specific one, is robust. Now I will say this, though. I mean, corporate actors are almost always private actors, and they can be treated sometimes as public actors. But a lot of times, you know, the corporations are pretty free to set their own policies. And so, you know, if they want to adopt policies that have an anti-faith bias to them, in many cases, they can get away with doing that, so long as they're not accepting government funds or working government contracts, etc. So I think that it's important for men to know their rights. I mean, that's a baseline, and many men went through this in the COVID era. Those who had religious objections, for instance, to the vaccine, could, and since those were government mandates in many instances, it could say, hold on, like I can't be compelled into doing this. Mm-hmm. But I think in some instances, you know, it's good to know what your rights are. It's good to be clear that, hey, this violates my faith commitments. But there may be some parts within a corporation, some areas where the Constitution isn't going to reach to you because it's a private actor. And then you're going to have to make a choice. You're going to have to make a career choice about what's really important to you or not. And I don't say that to be flippant. I know it's like, oh, easy for you to say, Josh. But I do think, again, we're in a time when taking a stand as a believer can really cost you something. And there can be a real honor in that. So I just think this is a time for boldness.
Yeah, I tell people, don't, you know, decide ahead of time where your lines are. Yeah. And when those, you know, figure out what you're willing to be fired over. Don't just go, you know, onto company Slack picking a fight. You know, that's a stupid reason to get fired. But, you know, if they're asking you to celebrate Pride Month or something of that nature, then, you know, be ready to take those stands. Your book, you talk a bit about rediscovering the duties of a man. Like the Epicurean mindset is so much about me, and, you know, fulfilling my dreams. What are those duties that men need to, you know, return to and step up?
Well, I talk about in the book the different roles that I think this adventure of manhood, this mission of manhood calls us into. And those are the roles of a husband and a father, a priest and a king, a warrior and a builder. And each of those has certain virtues, character traits associated with them. So for me, I mean, my own view is that the journey of manhood, which is a lifetime thing, is really a journey to character. It's about having our own characters, our own souls, our own hearts transformed. And that's really what the Lord is ultimately doing throughout our lives. But that's really what he calls us into, calls every man into. So I think, you know, looking at those different character traits that come from those different roles, it really opens up for men. Like, okay, so I may not be a father yet, but I can acquire the virtues of a father. I can learn to be, in terms of my duties, I can learn to be dependable. I can learn to be someone who is will sacrifice his interests for others. The virtues of a husband, I can learn to make a commitment and then keep that commitment and be counted upon to do so. The virtues of a warrior, I can learn to be willing to defend what I believe in and to defend those who depend on me and who are weaker than I am because my strength is for a purpose. So I think our duties, you know, is really are bound up with purpose and vision. And most men, I mean, I think this is something our culture gets totally wrong, our liberal culture. Men really, I think, thrill to the idea of duty. Most men want to be called to duty and sacrifice. They do. They want to be called to something higher than themselves. And I think speaking to young men today and saying, no, actually, you have more than just a whole bunch of rights. You have duties as well. I think it's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably not. It's a bit ironic that, you know, Call of Duty, the game is such a, you know, at one point was such a big thing for young men. But there is that sense with video games, you know, we allow them in our house, but we limit it because I could tell my kids that it's giving you a false sense of accomplishment. But I think boys are wired for that sense, you know, they want to achieve something. And there's so many cheap, you know, counterfeit achievements that they can get and they can get sucked into. What advice do you have for parents as we navigate technology? I know you've been working on, you know, opposing big tech and kind of keeping that out of the hands of kids.
Well, as I can just tell you what we do, I mean, my wife and I with our kids who are still quite young, as I said, my oldest is 10, 8 and 2 are my kids. We really limit screen time. Our kids don't have phones or tablets or any of that. And so they're not on social media at all. I become a big critic of social media. I mean, the more I see of it, the more I see the way these companies behave, the way that they target kids, the way they attempt to use our own attention span and to take it and to cultivate it and to grab onto us and then take all of our data from us, whatever our age is. The more I see that, the more critical I am. But I think that what we do in our family is no social media, no tablets, screen time is really limited. And then, you know, the boys do get to watch some TV, but my wife really carefully curates what they watch and the amount of time that they get to watch. I think that as kids get older, you know, I'm not there yet with my kids, and every parent has got to figure this out for what works for them and their kids. But I just think that you've got to be aware that the whole purpose of the social media platforms is to get your kids' attention and keep it, and then to extract things from them, to extract mm-hmm. information from them. And it doesn't tend to make kids healthier, you know, and don't take my word for it. Just go look at the data. The data shows strong correlations between lots of social media use and lots of mental health issues. And there's a reason for that. Those platforms are built to act like casinos, basically, keep your attention, grab onto you, and, you know, sort of rewire the brain as they do so. And I think for kids, we've got to be really, really, really cautious about that and really careful how much space we give to tech and social media, especially in our homes.
Yeah, absolutely. Senator, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with me about this. I appreciate you taking up this subject. It's such a needed conversation right now in the country. I've got, you know, like I said, three boys. We were watching. We're headed to DC for a family trip next week, and we sat down as a family the other night and watched Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And it's encouraging to me that there's men like you and others there on Capitol Hill that I can point to and say that, look, there's a Christian in the public square, you know, doing the right thing and fighting for, you know, righteousness. And I appreciate you being an example that I can point my boys to.
Well, that's awfully kind of you. Thank you. That's very encouraging. Thanks for what you do. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, I like to end. There's so many black pills in the world, and it's easy to despair as we're talking about, you know, heavy things in the state of the world. I always like to end the show with one question. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, my kids give me hope. My boys give me hope, and my little girl gives me hope. And I just think that the Lord, I know, has a powerful purpose for their lives and has a powerful purpose that he wants to work through them. And that gives me hope for the future of the nation. You know, I don't think that God is done with America yet. I think that our nation, there's more to come. And I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful that we're going to see we're going to see green shoots culturally. We're going to see spiritually continued awakening. And I think that this is a moment of really great struggle, as we talked about, where we're really debating these very fundamental things. But when I look at what the Lord is doing in the lives of young people and young families, when I look at the hunger and thirst for purpose and for vision and for calling in this country, I think that the Lord is moving in a powerful way, and we're going to see that really bear fruit in the years to come.
Amen. Yeah, I love it. I'm so encouraged with, I feel like this is such a time of opportunity, and I'm excited to be here. And it's difficult as this world is, raising boys to be strong men. There's no nobler calling, I think. So
I agree.
Thanks. Yep. Thanks so much, Senator.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Big thanks to Senator Hawley for joining me for this conversation. If you'd like to purchase his book, there'll be a link in the show notes. Again, that is Manhood, the Masculine Virtues America Needs. Really great book. I think you should pick it up. If you have found this conversation helpful, go ahead and share it with the men in your life or anyone raising men. This is particularly an area I think the church really needs to step up as men, young men are struggling in our society. I think the church can be kind of a clarion call, calling men up into a duty that God's designed for us as men. You know, we have a purpose, we have a meaning, a reason for existing, and you know, I think the church should really be calling men up to step into that role and embrace the adventure that God has laid out before us. If you are listening to this, ratings and reviews over at Apple Podcasts are really helpful. If you're watching on YouTube, like and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And until next time, I will talk to you soon.